Good afternoon, Mrs. Cherry, Justice Gibbons, Justice Pickering. My name is John Petty. I'm with the Washoe County Public Defender's Office, and it's my pleasure. Obviously, we're going to be asking this court to enter an order reversing Judge Flanagan's contempt order that was filed in an underlying criminal action entitled State versus Barnett. We believe that the written submissions that we filed with this court, the petition, the appendices, and the reply to the state's answer, demonstrate that the judge's contempt order against Ms. Ristenpart finds no support in the record, and in fact is belied by the record. And in a few minutes, I'll tell you why. Because that submission, I think, is fairly detailed, I'm going to hit just the highlights and, of course, answer any questions that the court has. At the outset, I'd like to reserve 3 minutes. I did file a reply, if that's appropriate.
Sure.
Thank you. To understand the contempt, we have to look first to a ruling by Judge Flanagan in this criminal matter that took place in a motion in limine hearing. And at that time, the state, prior to trial, had filed a motion in limine to preclude a particular statement, Mr. Barnett's statement, "I forgot my wallet," and in a minute I'll tell you why that's so important, "I forgot my wallet," as made by Mr. Barnett at a time when he was in the custody of two security officers at Raley's.
Sounds like an excited utterance.
Well, that's what Ms. Ristenpart believed as well. So what happened is they had the motion in limine hearing, and the state argued that it was a hearsay statement. It should not be admissible. They were not going to use it. Ms. Ristenpart asked the judge to defer his ruling until after he'd heard some evidence so that he could understand the exception that she was arguing, that it was either an excited utterance or it might be a present sense impression in the context of the actual taking this individual into custody. Judge Flanagan, at Ms. Ristenpart's request, agreed to that. He said, "I will, if the time comes and you want to have a hearing during trial, I will revisit this issue," and he said this twice, "I will revisit this issue so that I can make a determination with the factual context supplied by perhaps the security guard." But Judge Flanagan also said, "But as to the statement right now, that hearsay statement, I'm not going to allow you to use it." But that was the very specific limitation of his order. Now, there is no written order growing out of that in limine hearing, but I direct the court to page 18 of the first volume of the petitioner's appendix, and I'll read it to you. They're talking about this particular ruling, and this is the judge responding to a question from Ms. Ristenpart, "Well, are you going to preclude me my theory of the case?" The judge responds, "I don't know about the theory, but it is precluding you from bringing out that statement." And then the next page over on page 19, the judge also says, quote, "I am not precluding you from putting on a defense. You're just going to have to do so in such a manner that it doesn't violate the hearsay rule," unquote. And then finally again on page 20 of that same volume, quote, "As far as that statement is concerned, it is a violation of the hearsay rule and can't come in unless I'm persuaded otherwise. That's the ruling." So what the judge said was that specific statement cannot come in because it violates the hearsay rule unless later he determines otherwise, which would take place at a future hearing. As it turns out, there was a future hearing, and the judge stayed true to his ruling that it was a hearsay statement, that it was not a statement, an excited utterance, and ruled that it was a hearsay statement. Now, I can tell this court that I have read this transcript many, 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 many times, and you can go from opening statement to the very last period, at the conclusion of the last transcript after closing arguments, and at no point did Ms. Ristenpart violate the judge's order. At no point from any witness did she ask the prohibited question, "What did he say?"
Mr. Petty, let me ask you this, though, and I know that's the subject of debate, whether the order was violated or not, but wouldn't the safe approach be this? You know, you have the judge enters the order in limine. Now, you agree with it or not. You have a right to appeal if he's wrong, you know, like that, on he or she is wrong on that issue. If you think the other side's opened the door, wouldn't the best thing to do is say, Your Honor, can I approach the bench and go up to the bench and say, Your Honor, I think that the door has been opened on this issue, on this statement, and I, therefore I'd like your permission to go into it now. And then get a ruling from the judge. If the judge says no, then you don't go into it.
Well, Judge, Justice, that kind of took place at the conclusion of the first state's witness, which was the security guard, Mr. Robles. Ms. Ristenpart asked the judge if we could now reconsider the ruling on the hearsay statement based on some testimony that Mr. Robles had given. With
and this was outside the presence of the
outside
jury?
Outside the presence of the jury.
Okay.
At the conclusion of the state's first witness. In fact, the state only called two witnesses.
But the judge denied that request.
Denied that request. And Ms. Ristenpart never, ever asked any witness thereafter or before, what did Mr. Barnett say? She never asked the question to elicit the response, I forgot my wallet. And that is pretty clear from the record.
The problem I have with this is the motion in limine is granted by the judge at the outset. And the motion in limine asked a ruling disallowing defense from eliciting from witnesses other than defendant any testimony whatsoever as to any statements defendant may have made. So it's a little broader than your reading of what was granted. I'm not sure that all the statements were contemptuous, and I appreciate Washoe County's presentation as well. But in the gray area, we're in an area where the Glover case illustrates the problem, where you have attorneys crossing the line, whether they're prosecution or defense, and putting before the jury things that the judge has said are not coming in or may not exist. And so do you regulate that behavior by granting mistrials, or do you encourage lawyers to do as Justice Gibbons suggests and take up questionable issues before that taint is put before the jury? How do you handle that as a policy matter?
Well, there's an awful lot of questions there, and I hope I can remember them all and answer
yeah.
them if I don't. The first question is, of course, the most appropriate way for either counsel, defense or prosecution, if you have some evidence that you want to present or you have evidence that you want to present in a particular manner, but there is some contest as to whether or not that should take place, you clearly, outside the presence of the jury or at some appropriate time, seek guidance from the court, get a ruling from the court as to either A, is that evidence going to be admissible, or B, it is admissible and this is the fashion by which you can admit it. I mean, that is the preferred, clearly the preferred fashion, and that is in fact what Ms. Ristenpart did in this particular action. Now,
but after the judge said no, after Mr. Robles was cross-examined,
Let me see if I keep interrupting you, and I apologize.
It's the old bar examiner.
This one we used to. Yeah. let me point out this particular record, because I don't want to get into generalities. I want to focus on this particular record. We have two blatant examples of where there shouldn't be contempt immediately. The first is the cross-examination of the state's witness, and the second is the direct examination of the defense witness. Because in the first case, at the end of the day, at the end of that first judicial day, Judge Flanagan, at the prosecutor's request, took up a review of three particular areas where the prosecutor thought that Ms. Ristenpart had crossed the line or had actually got that information out, that hearsay statement, out before the judge, or out before the jury. And the judge said, with regards to that first ruling, that he was not going to find, that he did not find that Ms. Ristenpart had violated the court's order. Judge Flanagan said, and this is at page 162, and you'll find it at 162, 165 of the second volume of the petitioner's appendix, I don't believe that Ms. Ristenpart has violated the court's admonishments or the ruling of the court. And he also said, when pressed by the prosecutor, I don't feel Ms. Ristenpart has done anything that warrants any sort of action on behalf of this court. Now, in quote, the prosecutor was pressing this issue, but at the end of the first day, the judge said, no, she has not violated the order. Similarly, you go to The second day, the direct examination of the defense witness, while Ms. Ristenpartner was asking questions about observational facts, what did you see when this encounter with the security guards and your friend took place, to the witness? The witness blurts out, he asked for his wallet. And there's an objection, and ultimately the judge excuses the jury, and the judge offers the prosecution a mistrial, which she declines. But it is important to note that that mistrial offer was not predicated upon anything that Ms. Ristenpartner had done. And in fact, what the judge says in Volume 3 of Petitioner's Appendix, at 178, between 178 and 182, he says this: "It is absolutely clear in my mind that Mr. Button has every intention of trying to shoehorn every good piece of evidence in on behalf of his friend," unquote. And again, when pressed by the prosecutor to press against Ms. Ristenpartner, to quote her, Judge Flanagan says, quote, "I don't attribute Mr. Button's statements to Ms. Ristenpartner," unquote. So in those two instances, the judge has specifically said she didn't violate the order, and he's not going to hold her responsible. So those instances can't form the basis for the contempt.
But in his written order on the Button testimony, he does revisit that and revive it. And well, the problem I have is, isn't that a factual determination he's entitled to make?
No, not in the way that he did, and I'll tell you why. Because when you read that part of his order and you read it against the actual record itself, it is highly selective and very, very, with all due respect, intellectually suspect in terms of the language that he's pulling out to reach a conclusion that he reaches, because the record doesn't support that. If you read that order, you get the sense that it's Ms. Ristenpartner's actions that give rise to the offer for the mistrial, but it's not. The record clearly shows that it was the witness. And I submit that if you go through the entirety of the judge's orders, you'll find that it is a very selective reading. And I respect Judge Flanagan a lot, but this order is a very poorly written, poorly reasoned order if you're citing back to the record, quite frankly. If I just can conclude my thought real quick.
Go ahead.
I'll give you an example. If you look at footnote 5 of the judge's order, if you read that in context of the text of the order, you think, oh my gosh, the judge must have said something drastic at the time that all this was occurring. But footnote 5 quotes a sentence that the judge made back at the motion in limine hearing back in September, weeks earlier. So he's conflating and collapsing an awful lot of fact in that order to reach the conclusions that he reaches. I really wanted to talk about, I'm almost thinking about surrendering my rebuttal time, because I want to talk about the closing argument, because I think I can see you kind of wondering, well, maybe she violated the in limine order during closing argument. And she didn't, and the state concedes that argument. She says, no, she did not. What you have during closing argument is you have two individuals who are trying to argue disparate inferences from a core set of facts. And that core set of facts, briefly, is he was outside, he left his backpack with his friend, went inside, shopped, got some deli items, looked around, walked out, and got stopped. The state says, oh yeah, he left his backpack out there because he wanted to enter without the ability to pay, hence burglary. He looked around, according to Robles, looking for security guards. He was just generally suspicious. Ms. Ristenpartner argues that he left his backpack out with his friend who was on his cell phone talking to a friend, because you don't normally bring those kinds of things into storage. Everybody knows that. And even if the argument is, well, really, this doesn't have that policy, again, if you look at page 19 of the second volume of the petition appendix, you will see that Mr. Robles says, one of the things that makes me suspicious is when people bring their own bags into the store. So in any event, and then when he comes inside, he's looking around. Mr. Robles says, well, he's looking for security guards. The testimony is, no, he's looking out trying to find his friend because his friend has his backpack. So you have disparate facts. I mean, you have a core set of facts. You have the prosecutor arguing inference X. You have the defense counsel arguing inference Y. And we ask the jury to resolve the inherent conflict between those two competing inferences. That's what juries do. And in the course of doing that, that's good advocacy. It is not contempt behavior. And the state concedes that there was no contempt in the closing argument. I submit that this order ought to be reversed in its entirety, and if you read the judge's order against the record, it finds no support.
You do agree, though, that it is not a defense to a contempt proceeding that the order that was violated was legally incorrect. In other words, if his hearsay ruling was wrong, if he should have allowed that evidence in, you're not defending on that basis.
No. If it were the case that it is, in fact, a true excited utterance, but the judge said, I don't think it's a true excited utterance, it's hearsay, then it's hearsay. For purposes of that trial, it's hearsay, and you cannot violate that court's order. And your remedy is obviously on appeal if that's that's what occurs.
Yeah.
Okay?
Mr. Petty, I'm going to give you 3 minutes in rebuttal. Mr. Hattel said I'm going to give you 18 minutes.
Thank you.
I'll give you the other three also. 18 for the...
Thank you, Justice Cherry. May it please the court. My name is Gary Hattelstead. I'm with the Washoe County DA's office, and I'm here on behalf of Justice Flanagan, or Judge Flanagan, in effect. As you might have pointed out or noted in my response to the petition, I sort of share Mr. Petty's view about the critique of Judge Flanagan's order. That to me, it's not a model of clarity. There are numerous instances of action he found to be contemptuous, which I don't think really can be defended as such. And I've written that up and conceded those points where I think it's necessary to do so. But I think that the first question we have to address here is, the scope of the order, which is the question that you're interested in, Justice Pickering. And I gravitate toward page 5 of the transcript where the judge says in the motion in limine hearing, I'll tell you what, I'm not going to allow it, and that's the statement, I forgot my wallet, in front of the jury. If you want to argue excited utterance or some other exception, I'll take the jury out, but I don't want them hearing a statement from your client without us hearing the foundation before it comes in. And as it stands now, I'm not going to allow that particular statement to come in absent a pigeonhole exception to the hearsay rule. So we could probably interpret this in a number of ways, and I'll concede that Mr. Petty and I have reasonable minds, and reasonable minds can differ. But as I see it, it's a broadly stated order, and there's a subset, and the subset of that order is I forgot my wallet. So anytime the lawyer in this case goes into an out-of-court statement by her client, there has to be a hearing, there has to be an identified exception to the hearsay rule, and a ruling. And we don't have that. And there are several instances of that. Judge Flanagan cited 13 examples. The best I can do is 4. The remainder of the misconduct, by and large, entails what I would call garden variety forensic misconduct. Arguing facts not in evidence, using personal opinions, asking witnesses to making arguments based on non-existent facts.
And this given is that his order embraces an array of statements, a number of which you're conceding should not have been the basis for contempt citation.
That's my position.
Correct.
He might not agree with that.
You would agree, then, that we must reverse and remand for consideration and as to whether contempt would still stand on the 4 conceded?
If you don't mind.
I mean, not conceded.
If you don't mind, I'll cut to the chase. This should be the ruling. Judge Flanagan's ruling, refusing to recuse himself, should be affirmed. On the merits, the case should be reversed and remanded. The court should affirm on 3 instances of contemptuous conduct, noting that we don't know if Judge Flanagan ruled as accumulation of misconduct or just isolated instances. I think there's 3 that can be argued with a straight face. The remainder are misconduct, and under Williams, there should be a hearing. The old Williams case, 1986-87 case. That's how I think the court ought to rule in this case. The court also ought to note, and this should be a published decision, admonishing the lawyer in this case and the entire defense bar. That's what should happen here. This court has said, at least in the recent past, there's no double standard. We're going to defer to the trial courts to regulate the supervision of their courts, and we will rely on what they do. Well, here we have an instance of that happening. It may be beyond the bounds of appropriate discretion, therefore mandamus. But that's how I see this case.
Okay. And Mr. Howson, I appreciate you cutting to the chase, because we're trying to get to it here. we all may have disagreements as to whether or not it was, the order was violated. We'll have to discuss that. But I think this case presents a situation where if we do have an opinion, we can instruct civil and criminal attorneys on how to deal with this. Now, I want to ask you, if you don't mind, if I can take a minute of your time to ask for this scenario, because this happened to me in district court, and I'm concerned about it, and I thought about it in this case. I had a case I was a trial judge on where a lady named Jessica Williams was charged with killing six children out on Interstate 15 in Las Vegas. She was under the influence of marijuana and alleged ecstasy. And she fell asleep at the wheel and ran into the kids who were on a highway crew in the middle of the freeway picking up trash. And didn't do it on purpose, but she fell asleep and they were killed when her vehicle struck them. The defense attorney wanted to argue it was Clark County's fault for putting her out, these kids out in the middle of the freeway. And I said, well, that's a civil issue, not a criminal issue. And I said, yeah, you're prohibited from making that argument in front of the jury. And the attorney proceeded to do that. You know, despite my order in limine, in the opening statement said, ladies and gentlemen, this is Clark County's fault. This is why these children died. And I had to stop the trial then and deal with it. But how do we deal with these situations, you know, like that? Where do we draw the line and all on? Is that criminal contempt? Is it civil contempt? I mean, this case brings up a lot of issues here that gave me flashbacks to that situation. You know?
Well, I think under NRS 22010, it will be criminal contempt. I think sub 3 or 4. It's the same one at issue here. Mm-hmm. When the court, competent jurisdiction, issues a lawful order, it must be complied with.
Okay.
And there's any number of things that the court can do. And I remember the Yates case back in 86-87 is a Mills Lane case. And Justice Springer, essentially, for lack of a better description, launched on the prosecutor, who was Mills Lane. And there's a nice paragraph in there about all the things that a district judge can do in a trial. One of the things you can definitely do is stop, admonish the lawyer, you know, tell him don't do it again, of course. You can excuse the jury, maybe even sanction the lawyer. You can do all these summary things right then and there.
Outside the presence of the
right,
jury.
Right, of course. I'm just
well, we had a case called Ode, O-A-D, versus State. Judge right. Lane was sanctioning Peter Flangus in front of the jury and told him to empty his wallet in front of the jury and
right.
all like that. But that's it. The jury has to be sent out, and then you deal with the judge and the attorney deal with these issues in open court right then.
Right. And this case, this case reminds me of two other cases. And I argued that O'Day case. That was a fun case to argue, I can assure you. But this reminds me of Middleton, where Tom Valoria was the prosecutor and he violated an order from Judge Breen, excused the jury, basically read him the riot act, came up here on appeal, and Valoria was sanctioned severely. He didn't have to get his checkbook out, but his name is in the opinion, it's ordered to go before the bar, and he is dressed down. The other case this reminds me of is another case I argued involving Vivian Albitri. Of course, looked at that case about Blockberger and some other things, but that was another laundry list of misconduct. I can remember to this day, Justice Young sitting across the street, and he asked me with a straight face if my colleague had went to law school. That's what these two cases remind me of this case. You got a lawful order from a court of competent jurisdiction saying, depending on our reading the order, don't do that. And we have it. And I disagree with John and Mr. Petty about the context because the lawyer did ask Mr. Robles, point blank, what did he say? Well, we don't know what Mr. Robles is going to say. Part of what he can say is the completely improper particular statement.
Now, if the defense attorney or the prosecutor or anybody thinks the door has been opened, you know, by some testimony that's come out, and that, then making that information relevant or those questions,
right.
How do you deal with that?
Well, it's a tempest in a teapot now, you know.
Okay.
The defense lawyer, I still think, has to call a timeout outside the presence of the jury and say, look, the DA opened the door. May I please enter? And then we get a ruling, and if the defendant likes it, then we'll proceed, and if not, it's on appeal.
But you don't just jump into the questioning.
Absolutely not. And that's what got Valoria in trouble in Middleton. Because he tried, I mean, this is my take on it, and I argued that case, and so did Mr. Petty. He sort of hedged the order a little bit, but Judge Breen was not going to have it.
Was that a criminal contempt case?
It was not a criminal contempt, but, I mean, the point is, just by way of analogy, you know, what can happen in response to Justice Gibbons' question.
Well, my colleagues seem to be worried about and concerned that we should be sending a message to the bar, and I'm concerned about the 82 district judges, including 10 new district judges, who are now going to see a written opinion about criminal contempt, and we're going to be have a flurry of criminal contempt cases against lawyers here. And that concerns me gravely when there's others, there's lesser sanctions, there's other things that can happen. And I worry about what the judiciary is going to do, not so much what the DA's. I have friends like Mel Harmon and Dan Seaton that, according to criminal contempt, they'd be spending a lot of time in jail in the 80s. In fact, it was so bad at one time that we had to have a seminar sponsored by the Supreme Court about prosecutorial misconduct. And he was warned and warned and warned. And you know very well, you know those fellas that came out of Clark County. I mean, the cases you guys are talking about are mainly up here. But having practiced almost 30 years in the trenches down in Las Vegas, I saw a lot of what would be criminal contempt according to this case, but was never viewed as criminal contempt. Sanctions, bawling out, refer to the bar, there's a lot of things that can be done. And I think that holding a young defense attorney in criminal contempt is not the right thing to do in this particular case. I mean, that's where I look at. Now, also, you've conceded that some of the charges that the judge has made don't hold any water. So this is beyond a reasonable doubt. Well, how does beyond a reasonable doubt survive when a bunch of these charges are nonsense? That's my view.
Oh, I agree with you. That's why I said there's
And three. I appreciate the statements you've made. Your candor has been excellent. If more DAs would do what you do, we'd be in a much better system. Maybe we'd even get rid of Administrative Docket 411 and not have to worry about indigent defense.
Okay. I think my boss might appreciate
you,
that.
You get an extra 2 minutes for this.
I'll give Mr. Halstead as much time as he needs, believe me.
But coming back to the practical question, what do you do? I don't see any problem with a pretrial order. I mean, there could be some language styled up that we can give lawyers before the trial starts and remind them. But, I mean, a lawyer that's dead set on putting an item of evidence in front of a jury will do it. I'm not going to say this is the perfect example of that. But there's an argument to be made that that was part of the mission. That's an interpretation.
The problem I have with that argument is that a lawyer does have an obligation to represent her client to the best of her ability, zealously, within the bounds of the law, of course. But the fact of the matter is, arguing inferences, when the inferences have support in the record, is permitted. And well, even on this order granting the order in limine, it is. And you in effect, concede that to some extent in your brief.
Well, okay, let me be perfectly clear. This is not an excited utterance.
I understand it's not an excited utterance. Let me finish my thought on this for a moment. Arguing based on the security guard's testimony that this man went outside and looked for his wallet in the other guy's backpack did not violate any order.
And I agree with that. There were six.
And it is a legitimate inference from the security guard's testimony for this attorney to argue that inference.
That inference was not part of the misconduct. The misconduct, the chief, number one piece of misconduct, this is the one I've mentioned in my brief, is where the lawyer comes in and says he came back in the store and offered to pay again and again and repeatedly. There's not a single shred of evidence to support that. Nothing.
That's not part of the contempt order,
yes,
though.
Yes, it is. It's the very last one of the closing argument. The rest of it, I say, is garden variety misconduct because it argues facts, not in evidence. But that one is not in evidence. There's another one where Mr. Robles is asked by the lawyer, we don't have the videotape of my client realizing he forgot his wallet. Well, there's no evidence of that. You just made that up.
So what statements do you concede are contemptuous, criminally contemptuous?
During the cross-examination of Robles, the lawyer says, before there's any offer of proof, before there's any recess, before anything. So you came up behind him, yes. Grabbed his arm and stopped him, yes. And when you did that, he said something. Now, the order that I'm relying on is within the scope of that question. You cannot ask that question without having a hearing first and it's citing an exception to the hearsay rule. The answer might be a verbal event, but we don't know. That's why there's an objection and it's sustained. At that point, there should have been an excusing of the jury and say, wait a minute, this is a verbal event. The answer he was going to say is, hey, Thomas. The full statement was, hey, Thomas, I forgot my wallet.
Okay, so you contend that one is contemptuous.
Yeah, that's a violation of the order.
Okay, what other statements do you contend are contemptuous or qualify as contemptuous?
Within a page and a half. Roble says, in effect, that the defendant pointed to his friend, the guy unknown subject you referred to, yes. And that's caught on the videotape that we just watched, yes. And in fact, Doyle called out to the guy. Now that's asking for a statement. Now we may say it's a verbal event. It may not be hearsay. It may be completely within the scope of no recognized rule that the judge has set. But based on the rule, the order that I've looked at, any statement from the defendant, the subset is the particular statement. And that's just my interpretation of the ruling. I know Mr. Petty will disagree, and you may too. But you can't ask, according to Judge Flanagan, you cannot ask a question calling for an out-of-court statement from the client without a hearing. So those two are in.
What do we do about civil cases?
I want to hear the third one.
Oh, sorry, go ahead.
No, the other instance with Robles deals with, there's no video of Mr. Doyle reached into his back pocket when he paused and realized he forgot his wallet. That's just garden variety misconduct.
You're not contending that's contemptuous?
No. Okay. The third one is on during the questioning of Mr. Button.
Mr. Button?
Yes, and I've got volume 3, 177. And the defense attorney is asking Mr. Button about what caught his attention. And Button said, well, I was sitting there on the phone, and I heard my name, and I looked up, and Doyle was peeking his head out the door saying, hey, Thomas. Maybe, maybe not. But it's an out-of-court statement from the client.
And so those are the three that you contend are in play insofar as criminal contempt.
Well, the final one, and this, I have to say, this is a wobbler, but I have to say in all honesty, I'm just a little suspicious of the timing. Because the next exchange is, objection sustained, next question. What happened after Doyle peeked his head out the door? He asked me for his wallet. Objection stricken, and then on we go.
So your position is that neither opening statement nor closing argument contained anything that was contemptuous?
No, the opening statement asks, we're going to show by his actions such and such. That's not a violation. And then I think, as I pointed out, Mr. Button is on a mission. He was around for part of the motion in limine hearing. And the next question, about a page and a half later, maybe less, after the objection is sustained, Mr. Button, and do you look towards the door? Yes, I did. And what did you see? I saw Doyle barely out the door asking for his wallet. And this caused Judge Flanagan to sort of launch on Mr. Button. And I think this creates an enormous problem of coherency in this order, because what was given a pass is later found to be in contempt. I think that creates a huge problem of being coherent in this case. And then the closing argument, Judge Flanagan relied on six examples of misconduct as being contemptuous, i.e. in violation of the order. Five of those, I don't think so. And as you pointed out, Justice Pickering, there's possibly an argument that we could draw an inference from that, but I think you need to carefully review the record. I can go through those if you want to, but the last one I think is clearly a violation is the argument that he repeatedly asked to pay. There's not a shred of evidence to support that in this record, and that's not to be supported by an inference either, deduction, conclusion, or anything like that.
And it would come in under statements by the defendant that would have been interdicted by the order?
Yeah. He's repeatedly asking to pay. think that's right within the scope of the
so
broad order.
So the list of things you're contending were criminally contemptuous is expanding to five at this point.
But, and again, as I pointed out in the beginning, this may be an accumulation of 13 instances of impropriety as opposed to the three or four that I'm identifying and recommending. So that's why my proposed ruling in this case requires a remand.
We've picked on, I'm going to give you an extra, well, at least to answer my question or to respond to what I say. We've picked on district attorneys and public defenders and defense attorneys who do God's work. Now let's talk about mass tort litigation, a trial that goes 5 months long with 25 motions in limine. Now, how do we view this? Well, you violated five of the motions in limine instead of violating one of the motions in limine five times. I mean, I'm afraid we're going to create a monster here. Unfunded mandate, as they say, to this Supreme Court of people who are going to be coming up here on these major trials that Justice Pickering especially was involved in. Justice Gibbons did a lot of this type of work. And I saw a lot of it in the MGM and in the construction defect. I worry about that realm with criminal contempt on lawyers.
Well, even if you don't call it criminal contempt, I think that's probably the unfortunate business of being a trial judge, is you have to enforce your orders. And as I said before, you can look at Yates, and there's a couple of other cases, Glover. There's all kinds of things that the trial judge has in his or her discretion to deal with this.
Well, that's why I don't have a real problem with even saying to refer somebody to the state bar. I mean, that's pretty drastic, too, but certainly not as drastic as having a criminal contempt on your record. I just think there's it's like progressive discipline on certain people, especially our younger attorneys who are doing criminal defense and our prosecutors, too, our young prosecutors, too. I'm not here to hurt the criminal justice system. I want to make sure that it's a good system and that everybody gets a fair trial, and both for the defense and the state of Nevada, as they say in the jury instruction. So that's where I'm coming from.
Well, I certainly appreciate that, and, you know, court is,
and I appreciate your presentation here.
The court has, fine prosecutors. There's six or seven published cases. Who knows how many unpublished ones? You know, Valoria, it's his footnote. He's in contempt. It's contemptuous, quote unquote. You know, I don't know the scope or the extent of, you know, what the trial judge has to do in a huge case, even a minor case. But as I said before, I think at least a possibility is to send out the order pretrial, like we do in a lot of criminal cases in Washoe County. This is the way we do business downtown. And, you know, the lawyers are expected to toe the line. And if they don't, then, there's consequences for that. Maybe you sanction them one time, they get the checkbook out the next time, mistrial. You know, there's all variety of things. But in my cynical frame of mind, I know, and I think you do too, a lawyer that's on a mission is going to violate the order regardless of what you do. We just hope they're not on the mission.
Well, I think Mr. Hattelstedt and Mr. Petty might want to comment on that. I think all three of us commend defense attorneys that zealously represent their clients and raise the issue. That's their job. You know, our complaints usually are the ones that don't, you know, just sit there and don't do anything, and then we got to deal with all these issues on appeal, you know, that weren't raised. But, you know, where do you draw the line between zealous representation and violating court orders and all? So that's something we have to take a
look at. And what are the remedies available? There's mistrial, which has got serious drawbacks. There's fining people, which gets over into criminal contempt. The line is not clear completely when civil contempt stops and criminal contempt begins. There's putting, sanctions out, as Judge Flanagan did here, directing that the order be circulated to the others in the district court. That appears to partake of a criminal element. There's referral to the state bar. What exactly are you contending would be appropriate for the non-criminal contemptuous misconduct that you contend occurred here?
Well, I think how can we put this? What's sauce for the goose is sauce for the gander. How would you treat a prosecutor that did this? I guarantee you, I don't know if this court would do it, but I can guarantee other versions of this court pulling the checkbook out.
I mean, and that's criminal contempt.
Fine. But there are violations
of
this order.
You're splitting the hairs here because you're saying...
Well, go ahead.
Some of these are not criminally contemptuous. They're merely misconduct, yet you're saying they should be fined.
Well, I'm thinking ahead in terms of what might happen here. As far as this case right here is concerned, this is a remand. There's no fine to be imposed here, I don't think. because I don't know from Judge Flanagan's ruling if it's accumulation of misconduct.
What
or just
whether
three.
Minus the, right. the non-appropriate ones, it
but
would come
I would look, you know, if Mills Lane had stood in front of a Washoe County jury and said what this lawyer said in the closing argument about repeatedly offering to pay, and let's just say Justice Gunderson is here or Justice Springer is here, there's going to be a very heated discussion with me about why this man should not be fined and sent to the bar. I guarantee it. Other prosecutors, maybe not. There have been other lawyers in this office who have been asked to show cause from my office. And I'm happy to say in the last 5 or 6 years, and I do a complete statistical analysis here, but maybe 20 or 21 charges of in prosecutorial misconduct, one finding and one reversal. I think it's pretty good for our office, because back in the bad old days, especially in the 1980s, this charge was being leveled constantly over nothing. And oftentimes, there were findings and harmless error. And then we have Yates, we have Lemons and Associates, we have the Albitri case. You know, years later, we have Middleton. And I'm not saying that the court's approach to this was rhetorical, but it was heated. This should receive, to some extent, a similar treatment upon remand. Because as I said before, we have, I think, at least three pretty good ones. That may not be enough for a contempt finding. Because as you said, beyond a reasonable doubt, I completely agree with that. And some of these are close. Judge Flanagan, my words, gave her a pass on two of them before he lowered the boom later. But a lot of the stuff in here would get a prosecutor in serious hot water. Serious. And there shouldn't be a double standard. The court has said there won't be one. Let's see. So,
thank you.
Hope that helps.
Thank you very much. Mr. Petty? How about 4 minutes?
I appreciate the court's attention to this matter. I appreciate the additional time you've given me. I want to say that this there is, as I understand, no even-steven kind of rule, that because prosecutors have been sanctioned in the past, in the 80s, the bad old days, and they're doing better now, that we should use this occasion to sanction defense counsel just to show the bar out there that we sanction everybody equally, sort of even-stevens kind of rule. I don't think that that's what this court wants to do. There may be a case percolating through the system in Washoe County or Clark County or one of the rural counties that gives rise, presents the opportunity to this court to uphold a sanction against defense counsel, even a contempt sanction against defense counsel, but this ain't the case. This is not the case that this court should do that. I sat there like Justice Pickering and kept waiting for my friend, Mr. Hattelstadt, and he is my friend, to identify the three areas that he says constitute contempt. And the three areas that he identified are, remarkably, the direct cross-examination of Mr. Robles, two instances, one where Ms. Ristopart asked, he said something, and another one where he called out to that guy, neither of which violate the in limine order. Not only do they not violate the in limine order, but that very same day, that afternoon, Judge Flanagan said, my order hasn't been violated. That doesn't violate my order. So how can that be contempt? And similarly, with regards to the button, the next day, the statements by the witness, what happened after Doyle peeked out his head out the door, and what happened that caught your attention, and then this volunteer, he asked me for his wallet, those aren't questions. She didn't ask questions asking for or trying to elicit that statement. What did he say? She was trying to get him to identify the scene that was unfolding before him, because we know that Mr. Barnett had come outside the door, two security guards were on him, and Mr. Button was on a wall talking on a telephone or looking up. So the question, what did you see, doesn't necessarily require the answer he asked for the wallet. In fact, it doesn't ask for that question. So she didn't violate the order then, and Judge Flanagan specifically said, I'm not going to attribute Mr. Button's behavior to defense counsel.
If he hadn't said that, you would agree, though, that he could have found as a matter of fact that that was a contrived question and answer?
No.
An intended blurt out? So you...
No, no.
The fact that he didn't... The fact that he gave her a buy is important but not determinative?
I don't think... You know, but I know we use that language. He gave her a pass. He gave her a buy. Mr. Hattelstedt is very gracious to the judge. I don't think that that's what took place, in fact. I don't think that asking a question about a fact in the world, i.e., what did you see? I saw my friend surrounded by two people, which is a reasonable answer. I saw a scuffle, which could be another answer. It should form the predicate for contempt when that witness then says he asked for the wallet. I mean, unless there's some evidence in the record, and there is not, that this witness was coached to blurt this thing out, which, by the way, with regards to the Middleton case, there was a strong suggestion in the record there that these witnesses that ultimately resulted in Mr. Valoria getting chastised by the judge had, in fact, been coached. There was an undercurrent there that is non-existent here. I don't think any of the three instances that Mr. Hattelstedt has identified for the potential contempt finding actually work. And I certainly don't think, and this would be the height of arbitrary and capricious ruling by a judge, to sit there and tell an attorney during the trial, you're not violating my order, you're not violating my order, and then thereafter come back and hold them in contempt is, if you want to think about a chilling effect on all counsel, you don't know how to proceed in court. I mean, it's a minefield. You get a ruling from the judge, think, okay, I can do this, and then later on you find out that the judge has changed his mind. Mr. Hattelstedt, and I'll conclude his minute, if I may. Mr. Hattelstedt suggests that the judge just changed his mind. I think that he basically began to look for other reasons to bolster his contempt order against Ms. Ristenpart. But there we are, two people drawing reasonable inferences from a coarse set of facts that are different. And that's all that happened here in the closing argument. You have two inferences being offered, and let the jury decide what those inferences show from a coarse set of facts. And then finally, with regards to this offer to pay, if you read Robles' testimony in the direct examination by Ms. Hallstead, and I think also in the cross-examination, but certainly in the direct examination by Ms. Hallstead, at one point, Mr. Robles is being asked, you didn't let Mr. Barnett pay. And Mr. Robles answers, no, the crime had been committed. When he walked out the door, the crime had been committed. So there is a factual predicate in the record for that argument. Now, it might have been framed better or argued better, but there is stuff in the record from which that inference can be drawn.
And you're saying that was elicited, or those questions were asked on direct of the...
By Ms. Hallstead. You know, she also asked questions about, is it uncommon for someone to feign not having their wallet? I mean, that theme about not having a wallet did not remotely jeopardize this trial. And the motion in limine not to get that statement, I forgot my wallet, was never violated. So Ms. Ristenpart should not be held in contempt. She is a dedicated public defender, and she represents her clients to the best of her ability, and she did so in this instance. And Judge Flanagan, frankly, is wrong and should be told and need not be remanded for a rehearing or a further exploration. This court should just reverse outright.
Thank you.
Thank you.
This case will stand submitted, and the panel thanks both lawyers for being credits to this profession.